Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, education, Grammys, and the biggest weekend. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Bolt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Good evening. I know it's not evening when we're recording this, but it might be when people are listening.
Yeah, it might be.
You don't know when people are listening, so I'm going to stick with good evening.
No, but I will probably be listening to it, because I do listen back to it, because, you know, it's good.
I listen back to it, but that's because someone has to listen back to it before we publish it. You listen back to it after it's been published, so you don't even have the...
To check that it's working.
The excuse of quality control.
Anyway, it'll be about midday-ish, so do you want to welcome me properly as well?
Well, you say midday-ish, that could be just before or just after.
Yeah, you're right. You have to do both.
Okay. Hello.
Hi. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I've been affected by coming from cold into a hot room. I was outside in the cold and I've come into a hot room, and that happened a little while ago, but my head still doesn't feel right.
Can you not cope with a change in temperature?
No, I'm not. No, I'm used to just being cold.
Well, we'll have to move the recording of the podcast into a backyard somewhere, where it will be always cold, and then you'll be able to cope with the climate. I'm going to Belfast this week.
Of course you are.
For Output. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be good. It will be the first time I have presented the MMF Deals Guide, which you may remember we published last year, but I've never actually presented it. That's not true. I presented it to the MMF members, but that was members only, whereas this is me presenting it to the public. So, and actually, it's quite a short guide. So I don't really understand why you can't read it. But if you can't be bothered...
People don't like reading.
If you can't be bothered
reading
it...
By the way, the Dissecting the Digital Dollar book is out now from Amazon.
Which includes the deals guide.
If you're one of the few people who do like reading.
If you buy the book, at the back you'll find the deals guide. If you don't like reading, then at Output, which is a great event in Belfast, I will be talking everybody through it. And then I will be joined by two guests on stage to discuss all the various issues contained within. I am also doing two CMU Insight speed briefings, because once I'm there, I might as well talk all day. So I'm doing two speed briefings, one on Safe Harbour and the Value Gap. I mean, if you've listened to the podcast, I'm not sure I've got anything else to say about that I haven't already said. And I will also be presenting the top five challenges that the streaming business is facing in the next 12 months. You know how Spotify is going to list on the New York Stock Exchange quite soon now?
Yeah, that's what they say.
I've noticed in the last couple of weeks, everybody is writing op-ed pieces in the run-up to that, opinion editorial pieces, for the music press and the tech press and the business press. Basically, they're all why Spotify is ruining everything articles.
Yeah.
And they all begin...
The FT's one was good.
They all begin with the journalist saying, I'm a Spotify subscriber, I love it, it's really good, and now I'm going to write 1,000 words about how it's fucking everything up. It's basically the gist of every one of these articles. But most of them, and there are some issues with the streaming business.
Of course there are.
Buy yourself Dissecting the Digital Dollar, and we'll go through them in great detail. But most of the articles are latching on to the various talking points from the last 12 months about Spotify and streaming, which are nonsense.
Yes.
So like the whole Wixon $1.6 billion lawsuit, and they're basically saying that's proof that Spotify's not paying songwriters because they want to pay songwriters. And it's like, that's not what that case is about. It's about a rubbish mechanical royalty system in the US that doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. So that actually what you're saying there is wrong. They're bringing up the whole fake music thing again, which I thought we'd put to bed. That Spotify is not prioritising fake artists in their playlists yet. I mean, they might in the future, but they're not yet. So I think all of those people writing those articles should either buy Dissecting the Digital Dollar from Amazon, click the link in the setlist show notes, or they should come to Output into my speed briefing, and I will tell them, because there are things they should be writing about. There are some fundamental issues with the streaming business as we move forward, and I will explain what they are in this speed briefing next week. I think I'm also going to do a CMU Trends article. I might do the three things everyone needs to shut up about in relation to Spotify because they're nonsense, and the three things actually everybody should be bothering themselves about. So premium subscribers, that's something for you to look forward to. Those of you who have not signed up to premium CMU subscriptions, you can go away. I'm not interested in you. I'm not going to share that information with you if you're not paying us some money. So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, the FT one was more about how Spotify's direct listing, rather than going the usual IPO route, is going to be a great model for all startups that are doomed to failure. So still doom and gloom, but a different type of doom and gloom.
Going for a finance position
yeah.
rather than a Spotify screwing over artist position. Anyway, I think the conclusion of what I'm saying here is if you're in Belfast or Northern Ireland, come along.
Or hate reading and are willing to travel to Belfast, which I assume is makes up for most people.
Then come to Output.
I mean, why else are they listening to a podcast when we already write all this stuff down?
It's true. So come to Output. It's coming up this Thursday in Belfast, and I'm doing stuff there. There's lots of other things happening there too. So that is something to look forward to.
Speaking of things to look forward to, coming up on the show this week, hashtag GrammySoMail and the full extent of the BBC's plans to screw over the entire UK festival sector this summer. But first, education. The Musicians Union last week called on the government to review its education policies. This followed a BBC survey of 1,200 primary and secondary schools in which 90% said that there had been cutbacks of some kind in at least one creative arts subject. 40% said they were spending less money on facilities for these subjects, and 30% had reduced the hours in the timetable dedicated to the creative arts.
Yes, so this trend, and these are English schools.
Yes.
So this wasn't Scotland or Wales, they were specifically schools in England. And this trend has been noted by people like the Musicians Union and Basker and UK Music in the last couple of years. So it's not new news, although it is a decently sized survey that confirms a trend that people have been worrying about. And it's basically being blamed on this thing called the EBAC system.
The English Baccalaureate.
Which is a really confusing term because the baccalaureate in continental Europe is a qualification, isn't it? It's
yes.
sort of an equivalent to, I don't know if it's GCSE or A-level, but it's a qualification.
I mean, GCSE.
So when they launched the EBAC system over here, you might have thought, oh, are they replacing GCSEs with something more like the continental European system? But that's not what it is. It's nothing to do with that.
Because we hate European things.
Well, yes. This was introduced a few years ago. But so yeah, EU resentment was already setting yes. in, I am sure, particularly given it was the Conservative government in the early 2010s. Is that a thing? How do we describe this decade? Anyway, a few years ago.
I mean, it was in 2010, so you could have just said that.
That Michael Gove
oh, yeah.
introduced this EBAC system. And it's basically the way schools in England are graded and assessed. And crucially, the way in which schools are being assessed only focuses on the way they teach certain subjects. And those are generally the traditional academic subjects, like science and maths and English. And crucially, the more creative subjects, including music, they're not part of that system. So what that basically means is you could have the best music department, the best music curriculum, you could be doing all sorts of really great musical extracurricular stuff in your school. And in terms of what impact that has on how your school is officially rated, it has no effect whatsoever. And so therefore, with schools already under pressure to save money, then obviously you're going to be tempted to make the cuts in those subject areas where you're not getting any kudos anyway, even if you're doing it really good. And as a result of that, we are seeing cutbacks on staff and investment and how much timetable hours are given to subjects like music.
Yeah, so both Ofsted, which is the organisation that assesses schools, and the government have defended the current system. The government also insists that it is investing in the creative subjects, despite all the evidence to the contrary.
Yeah, someone senior at Ofsted did two things, which was first of all to defend the system that prioritises the more traditional academic subjects, but then at the same time to say, but despite that, schools still have to offer a broad education, the implication being there's still a bit of music thrown in there, was the official Ofsted remark to this BBC survey.
So as we said at the start, the Musicians Union is using this survey as a way of saying once again they think that the government should be doing more. And actually now the survey gives them some backing to say you need to look at your education policies and improve the provisions for music and the creative arts. But obviously the Musicians Union is focusing on music. The General Secretary of the MU, Horace Troubridge, said this new research from the BBC has confirmed the MU's findings that far too many young people are unable to access music as part of a broad and balanced school curriculum. He went on to say that government policy, and in particular the EBAC, is the driving force behind this situation, with the result that increasing numbers of children can have music lessons only if their parents are able to pay for them. This will do nothing to increase diversity and opportunity in the music industry. The MU therefore calls on the government to review its education policy in order to ensure that music is a skill that everyone gets a chance to learn.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of social class diversity to this debate as well. The idea being that if you have parents who can afford to send you off to have, I suppose, specific, particularly instrument lessons, isn't it?
Yeah.
Go and learn to play the violin or guitar or drums, then you're at a massive advantage to people whose parents can't afford that extra tuition, who are relying on getting that within schools. And if that is not being offered within schools, well, then you end up with a situation where there's bad social class diversity within the artist community, because the only people who can then pursue a career in music, well, not obviously the only, but the people whose parents can afford to invest have an unfair advantage in pursuing a career in music down the line. Now, I think the interesting thing with this, and it's this interesting thing that has motivated us to dedicate an entire day to looking at music education as part of the Seeming Insights Conference at the Great Escape this May. Because I think it's interesting how, within the government at the moment, if you look at the Department of Culture and Department of Business and the Department of International Trade, all of those departments of government are constantly banging on about how great the British music industry is and how the UK music companies constantly punch above their weight and how we have all these successful artists around the world. Some of them have even said that, you know, post-Brexit, music's going to be one of our calling cards because there's such enthusiasm for our music and our artists on pretty much, you know, all of the globe. And so you've got one part of government who keeps saying the music industry is brilliant, the music industry is brilliant. Meanwhile, the Department of Education are pushing music down the priority list so that the future musicians and the people who will be driving the music industry in the future are not getting the education and the access to the training that they need. And that disconnect is interesting, hence why we want to put the spotlight on this at The Great Escape. And I think, and this is something which we will discuss at The Great Escape, people may agree with me, they may disagree with me, although everyone I've said this to when explaining The Great Escape programme has agreed with me, but perhaps I'm subconsciously selecting people who I know will agree with me. Or perhaps I talk about it in such a forthright fashion that nobody dares to disagree. They're just going, oh, if I agree with him, he'll shut up. But hopefully at The Great Escape,
that's what happens with me. Yeah.
I will be challenged on this. But I do feel that often in music education, particularly in schools, often the focus is so much on performance and writing music and creating music, which is really important, don't get me wrong. But there is very little about pursuing a career in music or on building a business around your creative output or even on intellectual property. I mean, actually, Basker, which obviously is the trade group for songwriters, have been quite vocal on this in recent years,
yeah.
How you can do a GCSE and an A-level and a university degree in music and not once is copyright mentioned. And I understand that I am unusual in my passion for the complexities of copyright. But I would think that if you've got young people in a classroom and they've just composed some music, that's a really good time to say to those people, oh, by the way, there's this thing called copyright, and that song you've just written, that's protected by copyright. You own that copyright. Hey, here's a pamphlet that explains what that means. And actually, that's a much better way of educating people about copyright than buying adverts in the middle of X Factor, where you tell people that they need to stop stealing movies and pop music.
Well, that's always been a quieter part of the anti-piracy debate, but certainly one we've mentioned many times in the past, in that policies on anti-piracy tend to be, stop doing that, it's bad, and then given a fine or something, or taking people to court, but never explaining why it's wrong to download some music for free off the internet because you found it. And if you started in schools saying, this is what copyright is, this is how it works, you create something, you own it, you're allowed to make money off it, and that's why people get annoyed when you just take their stuff without paying for it, then that's quite a good starting point, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, talk to people about...
Aside from like then giving them the basis to build a career as a musician with the knowledge that you do require, really, that a lot of musicians don't have.
Yeah, talk to people about their copyrights rather than Universal Music's copyrights and Disney's copyrights. And we live in an age where everybody is a copyright owner. Because
well,
the minute
yeah.
you go onto Instagram and upload a photo you've taken, or you go onto Facebook and you write a little missive, you're creating content that is protected by copyright. So almost, we live in a unique age where actually copyright isn't just something that big movie studios and record companies and newspaper publishers own. Everybody owns copyright. Everyone's putting their content out there. So therefore, it should be taught in schools, and there are other places in the curriculum where you could do it. But actually, music seems like a really obvious place to be having that conversation. And I'm not suggesting that that should be every lesson every week for years. But you do feel that it should
no,
come.
No, it should.
That's all. They're allowed to make music one week in September, and then they can spend the rest of the year dissecting the intellectual property implications of the song that they wrote. No, that's not what I'm suggesting. But I think that should be included in the curriculum. And also, pursuing a career in music. Actually, most musicians who make a living out of music don't just perform music. They will have that, it's that expression that I don't like, but it sort of is a good term for what it is I'm trying to describe. The portfolio career that people talk about. But the idea that a lot of music people have multiple projects on the go. So they do a bit of session work in the studio, a bit of session work going off on tour. They may do some teaching. They may also work in the industry. They may work at a venue. So you do lots of things because no one of those things brings in enough money to live off. But together, you can make an all right living out of that. But having that kind of career, you need to learn about tedious things like tax returns and how you sell your services and all of that. So those things should be within the music curriculum. And I suppose my point is, if those things were in the curriculum, they were in the classroom, or in towns and cities where there are sort of industry-led initiatives, like the Urban Development Initiative that we work with, where you've got those initiatives happening anyway, if the schools would connect with those initiatives, not necessarily the schools have to do this themselves. They could bring those schemes in. I mean, urban development do go into schools, but those things are happening all over the country. If there was a little bit of business stuff happening in music, then you could go to government and say, well, hang on a second. This bit of government keeps saying the music business is really important. This part of the curriculum is preparing people for the next generation of the music industry. So therefore, there needs to be some joined up thinking here. And hey, education department, pump some money in and put music into the EBAC criteria so that schools are putting time and energy into this.
Yeah, don't just teach music as a hobby and treat music as a hobby. Music is a valid thing that can be a career. Lots of people, I mean, you don't just have to be a musician, but actually it all feeds in. There's lots of things this could feed into. If someone who works in music but not as a performer, it is good to understand how music works and how performers operate and make money or try to. Even if you don't intend to go into music as a career, it's good to know how the musicians you then go on to listen to and enjoy make a living, because most people's understanding of what musicians do is they record a hit and then they get rich and then they moan about how they haven't got any money. Whereas, you know, if there was a bit more education about it, I think people would be like, right, not everyone is Ed Sheeran. Not that Ed Sheeran moans about not having any money, but, you know, he was the first wealthy musician who came into my head. But, it's all beneficial, but obviously, particularly a Conservative government is always going to think, well, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic, that's the important stuff. Whereas, you know, creativity and understanding of the business of creativity is valuable for everyone.
Yeah, and actually, most of the things that we've just said should be included somehow in the music curriculum, sort of apply to any creative discipline. And we live in the YouTube age. You know, there are kids who are going online, using their technology, creating content, some of whom then are building careers on the back of that. And actually, most of what we've just talked about, that you would teach about careers in music, how the business of music works, a bit of intellectual property, would equally apply to any of that as well. And I feel that all of that stuff should be being taught. But there is the challenge of where do you teach it? Where do you teach that? What class could it fit into? And actually, it does sort of work fitting it into music, even if you're not going to then use those skills to make music. You might use those skills to do something else. So this is all going to be discussed in much more detail as part of our education conference at CMU Insights at the Great Escape in May. And hopefully we can get lots of people who are sort of thinking the same thing, but in different parts of the country and in different genres of music, get them all into a room, all thinking together. And you never know, we might start a movement to help address this. So obviously, we'll be involving the MU, who are very vocal on this, as are other Basker UK Music, some other organisations as well. So we'll get all them in there as well too. So hey, if you think this is interesting, what we've just talked about, you should come to the Education Conference, which is on the Wednesday before the Great Escape Festival actually kicks off, because our convention starts earlier than the festival this year. So why not add that into your diary, come down and join the debate.
Still to come, some news in brief, plus a classic Chris Cook rant about the BBC.
Can't have too many of them.
But now, the main topic of conversation in the music industry last week was the Grammy Awards. Although no one really had anything much good to say about it.
Yeah, you may remember a couple of years ago, the main thing people were talking about in relation to the Grammy Awards was the lack of ethnic diversity in the winner lists and the people performing and all of that. And this year it was very similar, except unsurprisingly, given the narrative that has been going on in the news and in the music industry in recent months, the big talking point was the lack of gender diversity. Again, both in the people who were nominated, the people who won, and the people who got to play on the night.
Yeah, so one focus of criticism was that only one woman won an award during the televised ceremony. That was Alessia Cara for Best New Artist.
Yeah, because the thing you know about the Grammys is, although there's like 8,000 categories, so there are lots and lots of categories, not quite that many, but there are something like 74 categories, I think.
It's about that, yeah.
A lot of awards are handed out over the weekend, but obviously, most people only watch the bit that is actually televised. And a relatively small number of those awards are presented during the television broadcast. And that is where all but one were categories where the winner were men.
Yeah, I mean, even if you look at the full list of winners, the portion of women who won is still pretty small. But in terms of the televised event, which is the bit that most people would be aware of, and I don't know how aware people are of the fact that there are so many other categories. They have cut them down quite a lot in recent years, but there's still a lot of them. I don't know how aware people are that there are all these other categories. So as far as your average person on the street is concerned, one woman won an award at the Grammys. There was also criticism because Lorde, who is the only female nominee for Album of the Year, was also the only nominee in that category not offered the opportunity to perform one of her songs.
Now, the boss of the Grammys, who runs a thing called the Recording Academy, so he's Neil Portnow, and a couple of years ago, when we had the aforementioned criticism about the lack of ethnic diversity, he didn't really help things by basically denying that there was a problem.
Yeah.
And he sort of did the same thing this time, but almost worse.
Yeah.
In that he gave an interview to Variety, who brought up the fact that there was a bit of a poor show when it came to gender diversity at the Grammys this year. And given that sexism and misogyny and sexual harassment within the music industry, and indeed the world at large, have been such a big talking point in recent months, it seemed to be a particularly poor show that this was a year where there was such bad gender diversity at the Grammys. And the quote that he gave, well, he basically said that he felt that creative women should step up, was the words he used.
Yeah.
And, well, the quote he gave, assuming Variety wrote it up correctly, which I think they did, it basically sounded like he was saying, well, the problem is there aren't really many women making music, and if only some women could make some music, and we would gladly have them at the Grammys coming and performing. Now, that's probably not what he meant, but that is certainly, I mean, I'm not paraphrasing hugely.
No. Well, he backtracked later when Billboard asked him, like, did you really mean that? And he said that step up was a poor choice of words. But that ignores the whole rest of his quote, which was also a paragraph full of very poorly chosen words. Well, like you said, it really came across like, well, if women want to get awards for things, they need to start doing stuff.
Of course, on the social networks, plenty of people then rightly responded to that by pointing out all of the incredibly successful, incredibly talented female artists who have put out so much great music in the last 12 months. The producer of the show, in another interview, basically blamed it on the fact that Taylor Swift hadn't brought out a record in because the Grammy year finishes at the end of September. So obviously Taylor Swift's new album came out after that. So he was basically saying, oh, well, the problem is there wasn't a Taylor Swift album in the eligible period, as if she is the only woman making music. So that didn't help either. Now, back when the previous diversity controversy was occurring over the lack of ethnic diversity at the Grammys, what Neil Portnow said then, and to be fair, this was a correct thing to say. It wasn't necessarily a good, valid excuse, but it was correct. He defended the way that the winners are selected. And he was basically keen to say, it's not that there's a meeting in a smoky room where a small group of people get together and carve up who the winners are, and that those people are deliberately picking a very male, white mix of artists. Because that isn't how the Grammys are voted for. 14,000 people who are members of the Recording Academy all get to vote. So a lot of people are voting. So it's not that there is a specific stitch-up that then skews towards one genre or one ethnicity or one gender or whatever. And so he was basically saying, we have all of these people voting, so there can't be any hidden agenda, and they know music, they're all music fans, so clearly the winners are just the best music from the last 12 months, and if that's a very white male selection, that's just the way it is. So that was the thing that he said a couple of years ago, and as I say, on one level he's right, that is how the Grammys are voted for. Although it's not a great excuse, because then there's a question of, well, how diverse are the 14,000 people who are voting? And when a similar thing came up at the Brits, to be fair, organisers of the Brits, which are also voted for by not quite that many people, but a lot of people, they recognised that fact, didn't they? They said, OK, it's not that this is a carve-up because a lot of people vote for this, but let's have a look at the people who are voting. Perhaps that's not a very diverse bunch, and that's why certain ethnicities or actually entire genres of music weren't being represented in the Brit Awards.
Yeah, so the Brits got rid of a lot of their voters, particularly people who weren't voting anyway, and they tried to bring in more people from more diverse backgrounds. So I think they bumped up the voting split to 48% women, 52% men, and then there was 17% people from Black, Asian, minority ethnic backgrounds, which was, I think, quite a vast improvement in the diversity, which, I mean, like a lot of these things, traditionally, the music industry has been run by white men who have got old. So now it's run by old white men and they just hang around. They don't get fired from things. They continue in these jobs. So it perpetuates. So actually, the Brits doing something to kind of dump those old white men out of their voting pool was a good move, but the Grammys seem a bit more resistant to that sort of thing.
And of course, we're not suggesting that women are going to vote for women.
No.
And that Black and Asian people are going to vote. But they are, hopefully, by having a more diverse group, they're going to be aware of more music that's out there.
Well, yeah, if your entire 14,000-person voter base is people who work in the country music industry, then more country artists are going to win. Now, obviously, that's not the case. But, well, like in the Brits, I think it was the controversy at the Brits was that it was a year when grime had done really, really well commercially and then was not represented at the Brits at all. And so they tried to get more people in who are involved in that section of the industry. And then that's obviously a thing you should be doing. You should be trying to update your voter pool all the time to account for new trends in music, because surely the point of an award ceremony is to reflect what's happening in music.
So this time back at the Grammys, not only did Neil Portnoy not suggest any particularly good solutions for the problem, he actually gave an even more disastrous quote to Variety. And on the back of that, huge amounts of criticism for the event, for the Academy, for him personally. Various people have been calling for him to resign, saying the problem is you've got these old men running this organisation who are out of touch. What we need is a whole new team of people at the top of this organisation and the top of the Grammys to sort all of this out. On the back of that, they have now announced a review.
Yeah, task force. I always think of task force as a shorthand for not really doing anything. You send out a task force and then you hope that by the time the task force comes back, everyone will have forgotten and you won't have to change anything.
Yeah, sort of going back to what you were just saying there, you have to hope that on the agenda of this task force will be perhaps we need a fundamental change at the top of this organisation. And that's not to say you have to sack everybody. You want a bit of continuity, but there is a problem, and I think this happens across the music industry, and I sort of feel it happens more in America than anywhere else. As you say, you have people at the top of the industry. Well, successful people in the music industry don't retire when they get to 65.
No, they
stick around forever. And, you know, they have skills, they have contacts, they are making a contribution. But actually, when it comes to the day-to-day of running things, they probably need to step aside and focus on one thing and support one aspect of the industry, keep their skills within the community, but let new people come through and actually run stuff. And in doing that, and this cuts across everything, I mean, the fact that the music industry was so rubbish at responding to digital in the early 2000s, the fact that the music publishers in America are only now sorting out a mechanical rights mess that it was obvious 15 years ago was going to be a problem once we shifted over to streaming. If you just had a bit more new blood higher up in the companies and the organisations, then I think we would overcome this stuff.
Yes, because like you say, Neil Portnoy An old white guy has been in charge of the Grammys since 2002. And like I say, he's past retirement age. Not that I'm saying he can't do a good job, but I think based on the evidence, he's not. And while it possibly is valid to put some blame on the voters of the Academy, it is ultimately his responsibility to ensure that the voters are representative of the current music industry. Also, it wasn't just the awards that are criticised. It's the performances, the whole thing with Lord not being allowed to perform or being told she could perform in like a group tribute to Tom Petty.
While you two got two performances despite not being up for any awards.
Yeah. And to an extent you can argue it's a big event. It takes place on one day. You just have to take who's available. And sometimes that's going to end up skewing one way or another. But Lord was there. You can't say, oh, we just couldn't get her. She was there and willing to perform as far as we can tell. She was in the room, but wasn't given the chance to sing one of her songs.
From her Album of the Year nomination record.
And then she didn't win. Bruno Mars won everything. I mean, that doesn't tell you that there's something wrong with the Grammys. The fact that Bruno Mars won everything, like every award, every single one, well, the three main ones that people remember, how has that happened?
So we're not saying, because we don't want to be accused of ageism here, we're not saying that the older guys don't have stuff to contribute. They've got lots to contribute. But in order to get diversity at large, you need diversity on every committee and in every organisation, etc., etc. And that is hopefully what this task force will result in. What will be interesting now, because we've got the Brits coming up this month, is will the controversy around the lack of gender diversity in the US carry over to the Brits here in London? So obviously we don't know, although
I do,
of the lineup so far, unless there's a few performances to be added last minute, the lineup is already skewing male.
As are their categories. I mean, unlike the Grammys, the Brits does still divide a lot of the categories along gender lines. So you get best male, best female. But in general, the mixed awards, I mean, Album of the Year, like the Grammys, only one woman up for that, Dua Lipa. And then in terms of the performances, you've had 9 performers announced so far, 3 of whom are female. And it just seems like the whole world has been, since last year, focused so much on the representation of women in entertainment and obviously, you know, the music industry within that, to then apparently not even think, oh, we should make sure that there's a good gender balance in the performances. It just seems I don't understand. I get that these things are big machines and takes a long time to plan them, but surely there's room for manoeuvre. I mean, there should be a good balance anyway. But now it seems more important than ever to really represent the diversity in music. And they're all failing to do it.
So we will watch this year's Brit Awards with interest, which isn't something we would usually say. So there's that. And also how the response around them are. But as I say, even if there are issues with the Brit Awards this year, at least the Brits has accepted the issues and is behind the scenes trying to address them. And so rather than the Brits following the Grammys, hopefully the Grammys can start following the Brits.
Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. Pandora is going to lay off 5% of its workforce.
That's the latest development at the loss-making, struggling American streaming service. That rejig and downsize follows the change of senior management there last year. Of course, SiriusXM, the satellite broadcaster, took a big stake in the business. On the back of that, they brought a new CEO in, and this is sort of the first big development since then. So yeah, Pandora, as an already publicly listed streaming music company, really needs to start making some profits at some point, and seems to be thinking that cost cutting is currently the way to try and achieve that.
An appeals court has overturned BMG's Safe Harbor win in a case against Cox Communications. However, it has strengthened BMG's case when it comes back to court.
Yeah, this was a slightly stupid ruling in the American appeals court this week. So BMG versus Cox Communications, one of the big safe harbor cases over in the US in recent years. BMG won $25 million damages and Cox Communications appealed. And basically what the appeals judges were sort of saying is, yeah, BMG were right in this case. But the original trial was a jury trial, and the argument was that the jury had been badly advised or instructed by the judge in the original case, and the appeals court agreed that the instructions the judge gave to the jury were wrong And therefore, that ruling has to be set aside, which in theory means it will all go back to court for a second time round. But on some of the other questions related to the case, the appeals judges very much sided with BMG, which means that if it does go back to court, then you have to think BMG's case is now even stronger than it was, which might mean they managed to persuade Cox Communications to settle out of court. But we will see.
Now, YouTube has played down talk that it's including non-disparagement agreements in its contracts with certain YouTubers.
So this relates to a report from Bloomberg, who recently cited sources at YouTube saying that when the Google business does deals with artists, so not the standard content partnership deals that thousands and thousands of creators have on YouTube, but sometimes they do bespoke deals with artists where they're actually putting money in to create content or to promote that content. And these sources were saying to Bloomberg, when they do those special deals, they put these so-called non-disparagement clauses in, which are basically terms in the contract that says, in return for spending this money, you're not allowed to diss us in public. And of course, there's been a lot of dissing of YouTube in the music community in recent years because of the campaign against the aforementioned Safe Harbor.
Well, actually, YouTubers have also done quite a lot of dissing because YouTube has changed certain rules and a lot of YouTubers feel that has reduced their ability to make money from YouTube.
So yes, on the back of these reports from Bloomberg, a lobbying group in America called the Content Creators Coalition has written to the judiciary committees in US Congress, saying that they feel that these clauses are Google/YouTube exploiting their market dominance to silent potential critics in the artist community. When US Congress's Copyright Office has obviously done a big review of safe harbors in the last couple of years, so they're trying to get all of this discussed in Congress. Meanwhile, YouTube have come out and basically played down the idea that they're inserting these draconian clauses into their contracts, stressing that the vast majority of creators on YouTube are on the standard deal that we can all see. They did say, although they didn't use the word non-disparagement agreement, they did say that there are sometimes clauses about the conduct of the creator, but those are in a very small number of their deals. And obviously, in addition to dissing YouTube, there have been some quite high-profile cases of famous YouTubers doing stupid stuff.
Yeah.
Not dissing YouTube, just doing stupid stuff, and that causing friction as well. So it may well be that those terms are a bit wider than just don't diss YouTube. They're also don't do something stupid. So they did admit that there are clauses of that nature, but they were very much saying it's in a really small number of our contracts. Although I imagine that those people campaigning on Safe Harbor, particularly in the US, would say, even if it's just a handful of artists, if those are big name artists, we would like them to be in our campaign, so we still have a problem with them. So a bit more YouTube dissing in the music community this week.
The show notes for this episode will have links to all these stories and everything else we've discussed this week. You can find those at setlistpodcast.com. And finally this week, the BBC has announced details of its biggest weekend festival. That is a festival called The Biggest Weekend, not a festival over the biggest... Anyway...
It is happening on a bank holiday weekend.
It is a big weekend.
And bank holiday weekends are bigger than normal weekends. But your point is valid. The event is called The Biggest Weekend.
It's confusing, isn't it? Anyway, The Biggest Weekend Festival is designed to fill the hole that Glastonbury leaves when it takes a year off, which it is doing this year, because traditionally the BBC's big summer music coverage is of the Glastonbury Festival. But unlike most festivals, Glastonbury takes every fourth or fifth year off to allow the land that it's on to recover a bit. And this year is one of the years where it's going to take that off. So instead of going and filming a different festival, the BBC announced last year that instead it was going to set up its own to fill that space. And then last week, it announced the details of what that will entail. So it's going to take place in four sites around the UK, Coventry, Perth, Swansea and Belfast. So that's all four of the UK countries covered: Scotland, England, Wales, Northern Ireland. And it will have artists like Taylor Swift, Ed Sheeran, Noel Gallagher and Beck rotating around all those sites and performing over the bank holiday weekend at the end of May. So that is brilliant. The BBC put in some money into music coverage, which is what everyone's always saying they want, isn't it?
Yeah.
Your face does not say brilliant.
There was quite a lot of positive response to this on the social networks when these announcements were made. I think it's a terrible idea. In fact, not only do I think it's a terrible idea, I think it shouldn't be happening on grounds of royal charter. I think it's the BBC breaking their own rules, is my position on this. Because, far from championing and supporting the UK music industry, this event is competing with the UK music industry.
Yeah, because, sure, Glastonbury isn't taking place this year, but Glastonbury is not the only festival.
There are so many great festivals that happen in this country.
I presume, actually, traditionally, most festivals, because Glastonbury is the biggest festival in the UK, it's the most popular festival in the UK, it's the best known worldwide. I would imagine the years that Glastonbury takes off, the other festivals in the UK would usually breathe a sigh of relief and think, oh, that will help us.
Yeah, it's an opportunity for those other festivals. And then the BBC comes in and screws everything up. So I always get annoyed at the BBC when they, as far as I'm concerned, overreach themselves. So the BBC obviously is uniquely funded. It gets, nearly £3.8 billion a year from the licence fee. We'd all love £3.8 billion a year. And they're given that money by the licence fee payer and by Parliament to make great radio and great television. And that is the BBC's job. And it does it really well. They're really good at making television.
They really are.
And they're really good at making radio. I mean, they make a lot of crap as well. But, I mean, in amongst all of that, there is some really great television and some really great radio. And they experiment and they innovate. And when you experiment and you innovate, you occasionally create crap. That's part of that process. But they also...
Creating crap is important.
It is. It's part of the creative process.
This can be part of our music education as well.
Yes.
It's important to create crap. Some of you will not be good.
Exactly. But the point is that the BBC's job is to make great television and great radio. Full stop. And I understand that in this digital age, the definition of TV and radio is evolving. And so I'm not saying that they only have to make very linear TV programmes and radio programmes, old school. They should innovate online, and they have innovated online, and that is great. But that doesn't mean that they can use their incredibly privileged financial position and the global brand that the BBC has built over the last 100-odd years to go into head-to-head competition with all of the brilliant independent festival promoters in the UK to put on events that can secure huge talent because it's the BBC and
yes,
they can barter coverage and all of that sort of stuff in return for getting these acts, I suspect, on preferential rates. So they're competing for acts, and even festivals that have great brands and a great following, those headline bookings are really important. So you've got a huge new player exploiting its funding and its brand to nab those important acts for its event, which means that those acts won't be available for some other events. Also screws up the touring network, because often what happens is agents are really nervous about booking shows for their artists on the off chance they get these BBC gigs. So it screws up everything for everybody. And I don't think the BBC should do that, and it shouldn't be allowed to do that, because the Royal Charter, which is the document that Parliament writes that says, here, have £3.8 billion a year, but in return for that, this is what you need to do, and these are the restrictions. Now, the Royal Charter is quite waffly. I know this because I read it quite recently. It's quite a waffly document, but it basically is saying you make TV, you make radio, and then there are certain public service things that you need to achieve. But you're not to go and compete in other aspects of culture and entertainment, exploiting your unfair advantage. So I think that things like this shouldn't be allowed to happen. Because I think behind the scenes, well, it's interesting because I always sense in the music industry, everyone's always really frightened of criticising the BBC, except when they try and shut down Six Music.
Yeah.
But everyone's always really nervous of criticising the BBC because they are such an important part of British music.
Yes.
Because they can really help talent get to a bigger audience through Radio 1, Radio 2, 1 Extra, Six Music, and all of the other stuff the BBC does. So I think everyone in the music industry is really nervous about criticising the BBC in public because they want the support of the BBC. And so a lot of people in public have been saying, oh, this is great, this is really exciting. But when you talk to some of the people, particularly in the independent festival community behind the scenes, that is where I'm seeing people really panicking about the impact that this is going to have on their events, on their access to talent, on whether or not they'll be able to sell enough tickets. Bearing in mind, a lot of these events operate on incredibly tight profit margins. You know, one bad year can knock them out of business. We've seen that in the past. And they're really nervous about this and the impact it's going to have on their events. And I sort of feel that the BBC is kind of oblivious to that.
Yeah.
It exists in this bubble.
Well, they've obviously gone, well, Glastonbury's not happening and we want to put on a lot of big music programming and, you know, lots of live music in the summer. Well, let's just put our own event. And you just wonder, did they even think, oh, we could go and film another festival? Or they go like, oh, we can't do that because you can't just do that once and then go back to Glastonbury. It's like, you totally can. I'm pretty sure any major festival in the UK, or just any festival in the UK, would be really happy to have 1 year of televisual promotion from the BBC.
Now, the BBC would probably say the reason it's called the Biggest Weekend is because Radio 1 already has this thing called the Big Weekend.
Yes.
That happens every year. And so this year, Radio 1's Big Weekend is part of the Biggest Weekend that involves all the other BBC radio stations and TV stations as well. I don't think the Big Weekend should happen either. That grew out of the old Radio 1 roadshow. And the Radio 1 roadshow was Chris Evans in a van driving around the seaside towns, playing music, having a couple of pop acts, doing a promo thing, and then playing silly games. That's part of radio. I mean, I don't know if it is relevant in the YouTube age, but that was certainly part of being a radio station. And then they morphed it into this festival. And I don't know. Originally, I was all right with the Big Weekend because they tended to put it in places in the country where perhaps there wasn't a local music festival. So yeah, they were filling a gap. We sort of got to the point now where there is nowhere in the UK where there isn't a local music festival. The little town where I grew up, where there used to be nothing, you would have to travel hundreds of miles to get to a festival. There are now two music festivals within 5 miles from the little town where I grew up. Pretty much everywhere in the UK now, there are great local events. And so the BBC should stop interfering and meddling. So I'm officially boycotting the...
You won't be going.
I won't be going and I won't be watching it. And I don't know if I've convinced anyone else of that through this little rant on Set List.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have seen other negative opinions on this. Although, like you say, I mean, in the live community, there's probably less a fear of pissing off the BBC than in the recorded music community. But still...
I mean, the labels have got nothing to lose. It's just free airtime for their artists.
Yeah.
It is. It's the live sector and particularly the independent festivals and the small venues who we all know are struggling as it is.
Yeah.
And I don't think this is helping them.
And then actually, you look at... last week, it was independent venue week and Six Music did loads of stuff around that. They went to little venues around the country. They had like Steve Lamacq doing like quite a long interview with the guy who runs a tiny little venue somewhere. I can't remember where it was now. That's really bad. But like that was really good because that's promoting like the actual independent venues that are struggling, promoting the fact that they're struggling, promoting these acts. And then the number of like Steve Lamacq would be listing off like, oh, these are the acts playing in these venues. Like, I've never heard of any of these acts and I'm supposed to know about new artists. And like that's the sort of thing they should be doing, like working with the music community and the independent music community to kind of promote what they're doing rather than, yeah, like you say, setting up this big lumbering thing that will totally tread over everyone else.
And on top of all of that, within the commercial media, so the newspapers, the magazines, the TV stations, the Rupert Murdochs of this world, there are a lot of people who just don't like the BBC and would like to see it shut down. And I think things like this play into that narrative, that they can go to Parliament and say, see, the BBC, it's exploiting its licence fee funding, it's exploiting its brand, it's interfering in places that it shouldn't get. And it's making it harder and harder as every year goes by to defend the BBC, which I believe there should be a BBC, there should be a strong BBC. I think it's brilliant when it's doing the right stuff. So I, unlike everyone who works at the BBC, as far as I can see, care about the Royal Charter, because if you don't follow the Royal Charter, ultimately, you play to the critics who at some point will manage to lobby the licence fee away. So, yeah, I'm actually saying all of this to defend the BBC against themselves.
Yeah, we're not angry, we're just disappointed.
Anyway, because this has been quite an opinionated edition, I feel that we've been recording for about 4 days.
Yeah, it's getting close to that.
So we probably ought to wrap up super fast.
Yeah, well, I think that's enough opinions and ranting for one afternoon or evening or morning, depending on when you're listening to this. But you can subscribe to the show to receive it automatically if you're not already doing that. You can like it, you can rate it, and you can share it with people so that they can also hear our opinions on stuff. You could tell us your own opinions. How about that? And email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Or we're on all various social media. It's Setlist Pod on most of those. But if you just search Setlist, you'll probably find us.
Or come and find me at Output in Belfast and tell me why I was wrong about everything I've said on this edition of Setlist.
Yeah. The show is presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. And for more on CMU, you can go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.